Ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great pleasure to welcome you all here for this annual Gore Lecture. So welcome, first of all, to the Abbey, if you're not familiar with the Abbey, and welcome especially to this season of the Westminster Abbey Institute, of which the Gore Lecture is now a regular part. The Institute was created by the Dean and Chapter to revitalise moral and spiritual values in public life and in public service. And this evening's Gore Lecture is given as part of the Institute's spring programme, whose subject is integrity. The annual Gore Lecture has been given ever since 1935, almost every year, offering a thoughtful theological contribution to the issues of the day. Charles Gore was a canon of Westminster, and he later became Bishop of Worcester, and then he was the first Bishop of Birmingham, which was created out of the Worcester Diocese. But he also created the Community of the Resurrection, which began here in the cloisters and is now for many years in Mirfield in West Yorkshire. And it continues as a religious community of priests in the Church of England. And it's a thriving community whose monastery has become an oasis of retreat and reflection for people in public life and ministry. So our distinguished lecturer this evening is Marilyn Robinson, of whom Rowan Williams said she is one of the world's most compelling English-speaking novelists. And we're thrilled that she's with us. Her biography is on your chair, and so I won't repeat the story of the many prizes that she has won through her distinguished career for her writing. There will be an opportunity for people to ask questions after the lecture, and one of my colleagues will be roving around with a microphone when that time comes. But in the meantime, will you please offer the warmest of welcomes to Professor Marilyn Robinson.
Well, it's a very great honor and pleasure to be here. I don't think there's a place in the world that is so strongly associated with this special treasure that the English language has been to the world. And both as a writer and teacher, I have had much occasion to consider that. So thank you to the spirits of this place. I will begin. I'm very bad at introducing things. What we are and do is as much a part of reality as gravity or plate tectonics or photosynthesis. Thought is real, and it matters. History and civilization, meaning both words in the broadest sense, are accretions of evidence of what we are. If scientific thought obliges us to understand ourselves strictly in terms that are this worldly, then it is obviously necessary to take such evidence into account. It is endlessly complex and very mingled, facts of great significance in themselves. These are no grounds for their exclusion or from any attempt to describe human nature. To put the matter plainly, theories that can only claim to describe what they purport to describe by excluding evidence that is utterly relevant ought to be discarded. And the reasonable presumption granted that an understanding capable of acknowledging the scale of the problem is to be preferred. Intellectual integrity requires a transformation in our thinking, a new humanism. The best model for this new thought is the old theism, which allowed for concepts like meaning and truth. We have escaped into reductionist notions of the human self that shear away awareness of such concepts and the ability to address them. The ugliness of the homunculus that remains to us distracts from the fact that this infantilization is escapism, that we urgently need to confront the glorious and fearsome reality of our capacities for good and ill, and discover or rediscover an understanding of ourselves and the world that inclines us to self-discipline and mutual respect. And here I get my reading glasses. The era of science, arose when the Renaissance and the Reformation brought acute and positive attention to human subjectivity. The mind became a sacred space where God communed with the individual in ways that enabled thought and perception in the discovery of empirical fact. While it is difficult to imagine a purer statement of subjectivity than Descartes' "I think, therefore I am," his subjectivity is not entrapment because God permits him his perceptions and God would not lie. Scientific inquiry in its beginnings was one mode of interaction between the human and the divine that arouses those gifts of the mind which were thought of then as proof of a human and divine bond and likeness. Scientific method proved powerful. Empiricism allayed philosophical worries about subjectivity until they were in effect forgotten. And the assumption became general that science could and sometime would explain everything, including the mind itself. So over time, the mind was desacralized, and the world as well. Metaphysics was put aside, and science, brilliant as it was, took on the character of dispeller of myth and agent of disillusionment. There was nothing inevitable about this. In the first place, the remarkable capacities of the mind in the Renaissance, often celebrated in terms of its ability to understand the movements of the stars and planets and their relative size and distance, were spectacularly demonstrated in the emergence of vast new areas of knowledge. Yet somehow that central mystery, the ability of the mind to deeply know the physical world, ceased to be acknowledged, even as its impact on thought and culture grew continuously. The most remarkable thing about the universe, Einstein and others have said, is that it is accessible to our understanding. Then the converse must also be true. The most remarkable thing about us is that our understanding is of a kind to find the universe accessible. A good Renaissance humanist, Pico della Mirandola, would cease on this as proof of our central place in creation. But as science developed, it put such thoughts aside. It dropped the great Renaissance fascination with our singular character as creatures who learn, devise, imagine, and create. Brilliant science celebrated itself, rightly enough, but it ceased to marvel over the gifts of the singular species that invented science and has persisted in it. Humankind has fallen in its own estimation, while the notion emerged and still vigorously persists that this utterly human project, science, is somehow inhuman. Among other things, it is usually taken to be aloof from the errors that we are prone to. Religion came to be reckoned among these errors. It began to be regarded as a crude explanatory system, an attempt to do what science actually could do, that is, account for the origins and workings of things. And on these grounds, religion came to be treated as though it had been discredited by science. Scripture, the church fathers, and classical theology have far other interests. Yet Christianity has been earnestly and ineptly defended by some as if it really were battling science for the same terrain, as if it really were a collection of just-so stories all along, rather than the body of history, poetry, ethical instruction and reflection, and metaphysics that had deeply informed, dignified, and beautified Western civilization for so many centuries. Science has not produced a sound social ethics or a poetry. It has very little to say about history, has induced little in the way of philosophical reflection. This is nothing against it, of course. It is about other business. but to put science in place of religion as if it were an equivalent framing of reality must necessarily entail the loss of many things that have indeed been lost. There are some transformations that are worth pausing over simply to appreciate their strangeness. Christianity, which had shaped literatures and cities and regimes, had structured time and consecrated the passages of life, inscribing human thoughts and yearnings everywhere, began to be tendentiously misrepresented, and very few seemed even to notice what was happening. This is as true now as it has ever been, and there are still those would-be loyalists who will forever insist that the Bible is in fact a collection of utterly voracious just-so stories, reinforcing the arguments of their supposed adversaries. It is a pity that Europeans took to tramping around in the non-European world when they did, corrupting every kind of evidence while imposing their assumptions on the lives and languages of the people they found there. Notably, in their responses to indigenous religions, they interpreted what passed through the dense filter of their incomprehension as primitivity, which primitivity was then widely asserted and assumed to be the basis and essence of all religion. This kind of thinking lives on among scholarly syncretists who propose that the God of the Hebrew Bible is a composite of local gods, a little El, a little Baal, a little Marduk. These mythic eminences left literatures which are a more than sufficient refutation of the notion that they contributed attributes to the God of Israel, but where a core primitivity is assumed, their very unlikeness authenticates them. In any case, in the course of all this, there has been a radical transformation of the West's conception of humankind. No one now would say of us, in apprehension, how like a god. A Shakespeare returned from the grave would be astounded to learn what that apprehension had been up to, how far it has penetrated into inconceivably distant reaches of the universe, for example. Writers of his period generalized instances of brilliance to characterize man in the abstract, the human species itself. We detach human achievements from humankind, whom we are then free to consider in whatever reductionist terms might suit our purposes. Recently, as economic units who can only act rationally in terms of self-interest, in every interaction minimizing cost to themselves while maximizing benefit, whether consciously or unconsciously, how like an angel. Wars, plague, punishments designed to terrorize and appall, lethal poverty, every kind of horror was commonplace in Renaissance England. If we think we have grounds for doubting the sacredness and splendor of our species, they had better grounds. At the same time, the best that we have done, the sheer mass of it, would surely confirm them in their high estimate of human capacities. This is to say that there is no necessity behind the extreme declension our species has suffered in its own eyes. In defense of this lower valuation, our moral failures will be enumerated. There are a great many of them, as there are in any age or generation. We may be more aware of them than earlier periods were of their own crimes and vices. If this is true, and if the case we wish to bring against ourselves might be called moral, it is interesting that we can, at the same time, be receptive to a model of human nature that is morally blank at best. Self-interestedness is not a trait well thought of in traditional moral systems, however demotic. That it is presented to us as uniquely and inevitably our governing motive puts an end to all the old struggles of the soul and moots old considerations like honor or loyalty or compassion. I do not wish to imply that people are no longer moved by such considerations, but I am impressed by the authority of an idea of self and others that strips everyone of individuality and of seriousness and of the possibility of actions that are original and free. What will Western liberalism finally mean if there really is no more to respect in citizen and stranger than this? So if we say that the age of science began with the Renaissance awe at the power and agility of the human mind, endorsed by the faith that its brilliance was to be enjoyed and marveled at as engagement with God and likeness to him, if we have now arrived at a point where the mind and the self are frequently said not to exist, according to contemporary theory, following God himself out of the universe of credible things, then it is clearly an understatement to say a tremendous inversion has taken place. The exalted mind of early science has given way to a flattening of experience itself that, on no actual grounds, is called modern and also scientific. This while science has made the tiny earth a seraphic eye that turns every way, looking always farther and deeper into the strange surging cosmos. I've presented a list of historical errors that have affected Western life profoundly, and the rest of the world as well, because of the assertiveness and prominence of Western culture. The modern period has been shadowed by gloom, nostalgia, disillusionment, enemy, deracination, loss of faith, dehumanization, atomization, secularization, and assorted other afflictions of the same kind. It has become an iron cage, and so on. Objectively, there is very little in late modern experience to account for all this moaning. By the standards of earlier centuries, we have been very fortunate. These days, most people see their children live to adulthood. It would be hard-hearted to consider this a small blessing. There are related facts, also non-trivial. For example, far fewer women die in childbirth, leaving far fewer orphans. In Western countries, at least, most people can read, a major enhancement of life. All this is definitely something to work with in terms of our having lives we can enjoy and make meaningful. And a great many people do precisely this. Nevertheless, as a matter of curriculum, which is our substitute for catechism, we learn that something has gone very wrong, that our human modifications of the world make it impossible to live a truly human life. The horizon open to us is still that patient etherized upon a table. An implication behind it all is that the disillusioned know something, the uninitiated don't know. The importance of that unnamed thing is granted, and the gloom it brings with it is given place in books, on canvases, in plays and installations, and everything that reflects its scale and coloration, which to my eyes looks like resentment, desolation, and self-pity, is ipso facto modern. So it has been for more than 150 years. Enormities have befallen the West during those years, which were wholly enormities committed by the West, induced in part by the sense of threat and failure and nostalgia as well that has cursed late modernity, both culture and period. I generalize, but in my experience, there is an alienation between science and the humanities that discourages humanists from acquiring more than a minimal awareness of science, poorly digested, while at the same time they assume that their own work is marginalized, even a little humiliated, by the triumph of science. Unaccountably, in this brilliant period, the workings of the mind, which uniquely express and describe the mind, whether as poetry or as microbiology, have ceased to be of interest in themselves. The thought has been prevalent for a long time that the human project, whatever that is, has failed and left us stranded and bewildered. The myth is that this is the effect of modernity with its disillusionments, the sad burden of all we know now. But in fact, our errors have brought us here. The inversions and misconstructions that arbitrarily, though as if by necessity, enforce certain conclusions about what life means and how it can be experienced by us. Intellectual integrity can be and often is understood to mean that one enters boldly into diminished reality, even kicks the rubble around a little. Intellectual integrity is not possible so long as we give ourselves over wholly to cultural consensus, however broad, however long enshrined. At the beginning of the modern period, God was a given in the field of thought, which was the seedbed of science in our sense of the word. This aspect of the thinking of figures like Descartes, Locke, and Newton is regularly treated as a tip of the hat to prevailing powers or a carryover from a kind of thinking they were themselves finding the means to leave behind. It looks to me from my reading in the period as though the Reformation in England, which radically isolated the individual in the fact of asserting his or her immediate relation with God, found consciousness, experience, a very rich field of theological exploration. Their exploration took the form of a parsing of the mind according to its functions and capacities, with the understanding that it is and is made to be the intermediary between God and the soul. Granted, of course, that anyone might choose to reject this awareness of God's intimate awareness of him and might turn away from the knowledge of God implicitly proffered to him. Adam figures in all this as the archetypal human being in whose creation we are all created and whose attributes we receive, fallenness famously, but also the ability to know God as Adam did. I confess that I am perfectly happy to accept this view of things. However, I can hardly recuse myself from a discussion in which, so far as I know, I am the lone participant. So, having given fair warning of my biases, I will consider certain consequences of conceiving of the mind thus theistically, putting aside the question of God's existence, simply admitting his existence with its effects into the discussion, as Einstein did the cosmological constant, not as anything demonstrated, only as something somehow necessary to making the rest of his system work. First of all, to do this resituates the discussion of the nature of the mind in our experience of the mind, our own and others, rather than in theoretical speculations about the brain as a product of evolution or the brain as a lump of tissue responsive to stimuli. Wherever any kind of brain is studied, except a human brain, the questions are, what can it do and what does it do? Researchers in London have demonstrated that a bee can learn to perform behaviors that are unlike anything a bee is ever called upon to do in the normal course of life. A very tiny brain is sufficient to produce behavior that might appear to justify the word intelligent. This is consistent with Darwin's late observations of ants in his garden. So reductionism in the case of an insect is inappropriate because, elegant as its suite of instincts clearly are, they do not preclude its having the ability to react to novel circumstances, to appraise and adapt within limits we will never establish since we will never know how to test for them exhaustively. Appraise and adapt. I use anthropomorphic language here, lacking any other, therefore lacking any way to suggest a distinction between human and insect purposiveness. Despite Darwin's little treatise, it has never been usual for a long time, it has been unusual for a long time, to make reductionist accounts. I'm going to start that over. Despite Darwin's little treatise, it has been usual for a long time to make reductionist accounts of human behavior and consciousness, likening them to those of insects, ants, or crickets, to demonstrate, in effect, that anthropomorphic language is not really appropriate in our case either. But better science undercuts the old notion that tiny-brained creatures are automata running solely on instinct. It appears they can sometimes decide when instinctive responses would not be useful. I go farther here than the science does in inferring self-awareness. In any case, as we learn that intelligence has been lavished on the living world at large, we should be less reluctant to acknowledge our share in it. It is increasingly clear that there is no baseline simplicity to which our own essential nature can be reduced. Mysterious intelligence is mysteriously pervasive. Bad science has for a long time assumed a not-so-great chain of being, an apparent rising complexity which is in fact only a compounding of simplicities explainable top to bottom in terms of a fundamental primitivity. In fact, we are an extraordinary instance of a pervasive complexity. Science has not proposed any way of accounting for this fact, not having been aware of it as a fact until quite recently. A theistic vision of the world is freer to see the world whole, as it is in itself, so to speak. The world is full of the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil, in the words of Gerard Manley Hopkins. Within this great given that being is an astonishment, any aspect of being can be approached with the expectation of discovering wondrous things. The slime that comes up from the depths of the sea in fishermen's nets is a ruined universe of bioluminescence. Microorganisms live in clouds, air moves in rivers, butterflies navigate by Earth's magnetic field. The matter cosmologists call dark, which makes up most of the mass of the universe, seems to be non-atomic. Wonders never cease. Over against this, we have a constricted empiricism that, building upward from the seemingly known or presumptively knowable, its expectations based on limited technology and on the old idea that science is a process of de-romanticization, demystification. To speak of this as the theists did, of lavishness, elegance, artfulness, is to introduce language capable of acknowledging that there is more to the world than its intricate economies of survival. John Locke, a theist, saw being as a great, boisterous ocean that will always remain essentially unknown to us. The more we learn, the truer this seems to be. To apply too broadly a paradigm drawn from narrow experience is an error that entails cascading errors. Classical religion brings assumptions of vastness and relation and beauty and wonder and humility before its subject, all very useful in giving reality its due. I do not wish to imply that secular scientists do not often bring these gifts to their work or arrive at them in the course of their work. It is in the study of humankind that these things are consistently absent. It is as if we can only be granted a place in the universe if we are made vastly less extraordinary than we clearly are. This is the kind of persisting bias and error that intellectual integrity would forbid. The old theist looked at extraordinary humankind, the quintessence of dust, to consider the nature of the universe. This makes perfect sense. We do, after all, demonstrate in our being what is potential in matter and time. Second, if we approach the mind with my cosmological constant still factored in, we can say the mind is morally competent, Adamically speaking, that is, in its design, allowing for all deviations from the ideal or the norm. I am not the first to note that modern thinking about the mind has often proceeded from the study of pathologies, real or not. It seems clear enough to me why Victorian women might have been prone to hysteria. I look back at the comparatively mild limits and prejudices I escaped by grace of the civil rights movement as if I had found myself two steps clear of a falling rock. In the American South, the intense depression observed in slaves sold away from their families was diagnosed as an illness to which their race was oddly prone. In such cases, assumptions about the nature and life experience of certain human beings obscured the obvious, and science built on the sand of ingrained error. I suspect this may be why the study of human consciousness is so markedly different from sciences in general. It very typically confirms or defends theories about social roles. The fact that it does not view the human person with particular respect as consciousness or, to use an old phrase, as moral agent, has a long history of grave and shameful consequences. The great anomaly here is that the science of the human brain, if science is indeed the right word, does not account for what the brain actually does. I have been invited from time to time to lend my brain to science, that is, to pass it through an fMRI while using it creatively. Even if I had not seen an article about how the machinery had been taking hair from the heads of experimental subjects due to faulty calibration, the thought that I could attempt anything remotely similar in such circumstances to what I do when I am writing fiction is simply bizarre. This is surely a grand instance of the application of faulty methods to a faulty question. The science of the mind, as it is practiced now and has been practiced for generations, has no place for human inwardness, the reflective settling into oneself that somehow finds and yields structure and meaning, not all at once, but as a kind of unwilled constellating of thoughts and things to which some part of one's attention may have drifted any number of times. It is in the nature of the mind to distill, to do its strange work over time. No snapshot, no series of images could capture its life. Walt Whitman wrote a beautiful little poem about a spider and about the workings of consciousness. He says, a noiseless, patient spider, I marked where on a little promontory it stood isolated, marked how to explore the vacant, vast surrounding, it launched forth filament, filament, filament out of itself, ever unreeling them, ever tirelessly speeding them. And you, O my soul, where you stand, surrounded, detached, in measureless oceans of space, ceaselessly musing, venturing, throwing, seeking the spheres to connect them, till the bridge you will need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere, O my soul. This could be a description of the making of coherency from experience, as the mind does autonomically. It could describe the making of a poem or the process of reaching beyond the isolation of subjectivity by means of those gossamer threads of inquiry and speculation to arrive at a kind of insight we might call scientific. None of these readings would exclude the others. That the spider serves so well as metaphor for the soul's musings places both these silent creatures in the same vacant, vast surrounding, places the soul in the world experientially, without condescension to the world and without rarefication of the soul. I note the importance here of the complex psychology intrinsic to the self theistically understood. The speaker of the poem watches himself watching, understands that there is purpose in his attentiveness, that it is itself a gossamer thread finding a hold in the delicate strategy of exploration he sees in the spider. He beholds himself in his essential humanity as solitary, as one given to musing and to discovering analogy and elegance where his attention rests. Science tells us now we have no souls, and science gives us no name and no way of accounting for the phenomenon of self-awareness that makes our thoughts, doubts, dreams, memories, and antipathies so interesting to us, and our frustrations with our faults and failures so acute. Granting that the soul as an idea might be culturally particular enough that it gives self-awareness a character not intrinsic to it, the classic soul is more ourselves than we are, a loving and well-loved companion, loyal to us uniquely, entrusted to us, to whom we entrust ourselves. We feel its yearnings, its musings, as a truer and more primary experience of ourselves than our ordinary consciousness can offer us. Traditionally, souls are spoken of as saved or lost, being the immortal part of humankind, even though they are also thought of as unoffending, indeed as offended against when we misuse our worldly agency. Freud's superego bears a superficial resemblance to the soul, the great difference being that the superego is the internalization of strictures and demands that are not one's own or friendly to one's well-being, and that intervene in the formation of a primary self. The old song says, it is well with my soul. No song says it is well with my superego. That would describe a state of utter capitulation to a harsh authority enforced by a submerged but dreadful guilt. It is interesting to consider what we have received in exchange for the theistic worldview of our ancestors. Psychological complexity is acknowledged in modern theories of the mind, in Freud's tripartite psyche, in notions of an unevolved reptilian brain coiled at the base of consciousness, in bicameralism, and recently in the brain as a sort of calculator making continuous and presumably accurate estimate of the organism's relative advantage, cost-benefit analysis in the terms of economics, the discipline whose prestige seems to have overwhelmed what remained of humanist impulses in this field. Complexity enters the schema because some undescribed mechanism intervenes to conceal our selfishness from ourselves, to allow us to believe that our generosity actually is generosity, and so on. Why, if self-interest is the unique and universal motive, any shame or blame would attach to it is one question. Another is, what would this system of concealment look like as biology or neurology? And would its complexity, its physiological cost, be repaid by concealments that hardly seem necessary in the first place, given the selfishness thesis? In any case, all this complexity takes place in isolation within the standard human skull, which is not a very pleasant place to be. I suppose this is both a source and a consequence of modernist malaise. My soul, by grace of God, has fared adventuring where wonders be. These are lines from a poem, Pearl, written in the 14th century. The voice of the poem describes a dream vision of a girl child who has died. The speaker sees her as a lovely young woman by a river in a paradise he cannot yet enter. The poem speaks beautifully and tellingly of such loss, acknowledging a depth of grief that is, finally, embraced in the consolations of a cosmic order that is as tender and profound as such sorrows would require. We might call this wish fulfillment, the projection of human hopes on an empty heaven. Or we might call it a vision of being that is large and rich enough to accommodate the experience of human love and grief. How else to do justice to them? Pearl movingly evokes a young child's translucent loveliness, and pearls adorn the sleeve of the cosmic Christ. The garden where the child is buried is a faint but real promise of the paradise where her soul flourishes. The beauty we see in this world is a sign and portent of an ultimate beauty, and we are rightly enthralled by it. Beauty has no place in modern theories of the mind, nor do the pleasures of memory, thought, or perception, or the aesthetic pleasures. Endorphins are not adequate to filling this void. They only mean that pleasure happens, as I hope we all know, even without that word. My argument is essentially that the universe of theism is large enough not only to admit of the great range of human emotion and imagination, pathos and grandeur, but to embrace these things, to value them, even when they are never noticed or valued or, for that matter, expressed in the whole of a mortal life. Unless it is to distinguish itself very sharply from theistic tradition, I have no idea why the various psychologies are alike in disallowing the more ingratiating human traits. Religion is represented as a repressive system from which modern thought is a liberation. Yet all these psychologies are bleakly determinist and so poor in their view of the possible that it is impossible to guess what their version of a free act would look like. The notion that all behavior is essentially self-interested might liberate selfishness, but that would be no more than a slight deviation from a pattern of behavior that is inevitable in any case. If decency is merely feigned, the enabler of selfishness, it might be no deviation at all. I grant all the problems associated with the doctrine of predestination, and I find it a vastly deeper problem to be asked to subscribe to the idea that meaninglessness is irresistibly implanted in human nature, that superego will wrestle id to a draw, that the reptile will not hiss and draw embarrassing attention to itself, that the hand in the collection plate will appear to be putting something in, not taking something out. A better modernist anthropology might change my sense of all this, but as it is, I think it is entirely appropriate to evaluate what there is on offer. In case there are doubts, this really is a lecture on the subject of intellectual integrity, a thing many of us have felt to be sorely lacking these days. Why is it so difficult to find the language to approach this subject? Well, for one thing, these psychologies I mentioned imply or say outright that there is no mind. Then how do we speak of intellectualism? These psychologies imply or say outright that there is no self. Then how do we speak of integrity? The notion has caught on very widely that there are no facts, only interpretations. Truth itself is dissolving as a concept in an acid bath of idle cynicism. So to what standard are the ethically inclined to hold themselves? Who knows to what extent the thought of a period is what we take it to be, but modern thought especially has been made a curriculum and a catechism. There are no grounds for doubting its influence. Again, in the matter of intellect or ethicalism, it is conspicuously lacking in terms to address these things or to value them. For a very long time, it has been assumed that intellectual integrity in the modern period demanded the rejection of religion. As corollary, there is the assumption that we must adopt the worldview of the modern period. This subtle coercion to embrace certain ideas on other grounds than their merits might explain their survival, despite their being, from a human point of view, desiccated things, deeply unsatisfactory. And this, while brilliant science continuously sets before us a vaster, more cryptic, and spectacular cosmos, the brilliant human mind being mirror and alembic of all this grandeur, as it has always been. The modern science of the mind is to science in general as a blighted twin to a living body, mimic life and thwarted development. I propose that this is true because it epitomizes the modern as a concept. It is first of all a worldview. The methods of the science that sponsors it presuppose its validity. The soul will never reveal itself to an fMRI, and poetry, prayers, painting and architecture are inadmissible as evidence. These theories of the mind change to the extent they do as cultural styles change, not in the way of hypotheses that are winnowed and refined in the ordinary course of inquiry. I use the word mind here because their attentions to the brain yield by their lights insights of global validity into human nature, even in the kind of inwardness implied in a deceptive valuation of one's own and others' motives. To say that they learned this from scrutiny of the brain would be false. The idea goes back at least to Freud. Most of you probably know that Einstein's great mistake, the constant he added into the theory to make the equations work as he wanted, and which he regretted ever afterward, has turned out to be no mistake at all, but an anticipation of the effect of dark energy as anti-gravity. I skirt specifics because I don't really understand them, but there is a point to my analogy. If a theoretical account of the order of things does not describe what reason or intuition propose to the understanding, then the factor that would correct for its deficiency should be looked to, pondered. The modern mind, insofar as it is proposed to humankind, the modern world, insofar as it is proposed to humankind as its habitation, is too small, too dull, too meager for us. After all, we are very remarkable. We alone among the creatures have learned a bit of the grammar of the universe. Einstein was known to mention God from time to time, which need not imply theism in any traditional form, only the sense of a universe more intrinsically orderly, capacious, and finally unknowable than theory and formula could capture. For him, the Lord seems to have been another cosmological constant, an undemonstrated given necessary to allowing the reality he wished to describe its full character. We have in ourselves grounds for supposing that being is vaster, more luminous, more consequential than we have allowed ourselves to imagine for many generations. Intellectual rigor is not inevitably reductionist. Intellectual integrity cannot oblige us to deny what is manifestly true. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've heard the most complex and beautiful lecture on the complexity and beauty and mystery of life and of the created order. I find myself thinking of the people who were name-checked, T.S. Eliot back there in Poets' Corner, Gerald Manley Hopkins back there in Poets' Corner, Charles Darwin buried just over here, Isaac Newton buried just here. I asked myself the question whether the scientists amongst them would have risen up. There are others here, risen up and said, oh no, we don't agree with this at all, but I think they might have found a great deal that they do agree with. Now, there is an opportunity for people to engage with Professor Robinson with questions or indeed with comments. So who would like to dare to go first? Well, don't dare, just go first. Yes, there's one here, third row. There's a microphone coming. Do you please stand up and say who you are and then make your comment?
Sorry, my name is Farolith Horden. In your lecture, in the thrust of your argument, it's a very progressive. You see us going forward in a line. Do you believe in the cyclical nature and that actually things may come around, but suddenly or gradually somebody will have this idea that the soul, the mind, is more than a reduction?
Well, that's me. I count. But in any case, I don't know about the cyclical nature of things. It's very interesting. I think that there's a way in which, ironically, we exist in history in a very exceptional way because we have access to centuries and centuries of thinking, much of it extremely beautiful. And so there could, if we could simply rediscover something that, as the Renaissance did itself, rediscover a huge well of beautiful other ways of thinking that are much more fruitful, I mean, much more adequate to their subject than what we do now. I've been looking at 17th century writers and, you know, talking about the soul and the will and the, you know, the conscience is very, very big. But talking about them in such subtle ways, you know, they talk about experimental religion, which means experiential religion. How does a conscience live in your mind, you know? And it's very beautiful to see the kind of attention that they pay. We have the resources. So for some reason, we don't destroy history. We just forget it, you know?
Thank you. Yes, just here, fourth row.
Thank you. I
found
what you said.
Stand up and tell us who you are.
I thought what you said was fascinating. And I wondered if you might say something about where science and a more mystical dimension, if you like, are meeting at the moment in terms of a quantum model of the world that actually echoes what the 17th century poets or the mystic throughout the ages have been talking about.
That is very true. It's ironic in a way that as science was developing and becoming very powerful and very efficacious in many ways, it seems to have lost that intuitive sense of what reality is like that you find in pre-scientific writers often, or people just on the cusp, you know. You know, the way that Locke, for example, describes the universe is a very deep intuition. When you look at someone like Einstein, and in his earlier career, he thought, you know, that our galaxy was the whole universe. There was, you know, and that it was static and all sorts of things. But you can't read people like Locke without knowing that he has an intuition of a much vaster, much more complex reality. and this is very often true, I think that we created a false model of reality. Now we're trying, you know, now we know all sorts of things that should disrupt it, but we don't have the language for it.
Thank you very much. Yes, right at the back, near the back there. Near the pillar? The Bishop of Worcester.
Thank you very much indeed for a wonderful lecture. You mentioned that a moment ago the vast body of knowledge that we have available to us now and how that's unprecedented. I wonder whether that can be a burden as well as a blessing in the sense that we've become so specialised. You mentioned the 17th century. I think of the 17th century priest and poet Thomas Traherne, who writes most beautifully and gloriously prose and poetry, but was also very, very interested in and knowledgeable about scientific progress at that time and tried to integrate the two in a way which seems not to be attractive or even possible to people now.
Yes. One of the things that I, you know, try to talk about or write about is the fact that we've created this dichotomy in Western culture where, you know, the humanities are on one side and then way far away, you know, is science. And when you read, you know, about how a wound heals, you know, or about how a star collapses on itself, or any number of these things, they're absolutely beautiful. They fall under the mantle of the aesthetically overwhelming, you know? And it's a terrible loss that humanists are not aware of what's going on scientifically, and vice versa, no doubt. And it's because we've put this kind of curse on the idea of science by treating it as if it were inhuman rather than being the most human thing you could imagine. Why do we keep doing it? You know, why have people persisted in something that looks a lot like science when the rewards from it must have still been so gradual for such a long time? It's something about us, and it's a beautiful, interesting thing.
Yes, over here.
Chris Adams, I'm a fellow at the Institute. Isn't really the crux of your talk very much about different kinds of truth? That scientific truth can almost is what is can be proven what how something functions, whereas theistic truth is almost what can be felt, and that there seems to have been a lack of understanding that they're two different things, but they shouldn't be in a way that there's this searching for truth which isn't looking at it holistically.
Yes, if I've understood your question, I think that, you know, at the same time that we've sort of encapsulated science on one side of things, we've also encapsulated religion and theology on the other side. I think that, you know, as in the previous question, many profoundly religious thinkers have a very strong scientific intuition. I think that a lot of religious people actually understand reality as a pilgrimage or as a question, you know, that would produce science in a lot of the earlier people, you know, Newton, for example. I think that a lot of our dichotomies are very false and really need to be scrutinized.
Over here.
Welcome to what in England we call a new build. My question is, to what extent do you think that what we normally call consumerism affects intellectual tradition as it's now developed and how we think about things, and whether that affects truth claims about science or even about religion?
Well, I think that there is a sort of a collective false consciousness that goes into talking each other into feeling they need things they don't need and all that sort of thing, you know. I mean, who knows how people in general respond to that kind of thing? I mean, for weal or woe, and there's probably a good deal of woe involved, we've learned not to take a great deal of the language that we hear seriously or take it as attempting to say anything true. On the other hand, when I'm writing and it's dinner time, I can get a sandwich. You know, was this always true for all the people that wrote in earlier periods? Could they have safe drinking water whenever they wanted it? Could they sleep warmly whenever they wanted to? No. I think that all those things would be a greater distraction to me if I couldn't take them for granted. So there's a certain level at which our material comfort is not an excuse.
Yes, there's one more there.
Thank you so much. I would be really interested in your thoughts on mindfulness, which is now becoming huge in Western psychology, and which seems to acknowledge that we are beings, rather than just reducing our experience to something you can explain.
I think it's a perfectly nice impulse. I don't know how. I have a very great prejudice for things that I can imagine as being larger explanatory systems. You know, like, why is there such a thing as a human mind? I mean, you read these things, scientific magazines that say the human brain is the most complex object known to exist in the universe. This is science, right? Everybody has a human brain. Isn't that amazing? We are the quintessence of dust, Why is it that there seems to be intelligence as a pervasive quality in at least, conscious being, and B, that we would have it in such an extraordinary form, which, I'm speaking as a teacher, but if you could ever get people to actually find out what it is that they have by way of mind, it would be wonderful. Most people just kind of sleep through existence without ever really asking themselves that question, which I think is a reason enough to think again about what a mind is.
Well, Professor Robinson, I think you've woken us up this evening beautifully. And one of my colleagues, Canon Werner White, talks about disenchantment. And I suppose the opposite of disenchantment is re-enchantment. But I don't think this has been exactly re-enchantment, but it's certainly been enchanting and delightful. And we're immensely grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.